You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Ball, as in bocce? Jack O'Neill, Story SG-1, Season 6, Episode 6, Abyss. Ball is one of those incredibly popular gods, and I'm not just talking about the Gua'uld in Stargate SG-1, the TV series, and the final film, Stargate Continuum. Yes, he was a brilliant villain, such sass, and at times, an incredibly reluctant anti-hero, even though he would brag about saving the world any chance he gets, which I'll get to. But no, I'm talking about the actual god, Ball. The one that doesn't have the alien parasite in his head. I'm talking about the storm god that was beloved by his people, but later demonized by all subsequent Christian-ish based religions, as in literally turning him into a demon, or at least connected to demons and evil within the text. Hi, my name's Renee. You're listening to Detours in Archaeology, and this is Lord of the Storm, Lord of the Clones. Ball from Ugarit to Stargate. While he wasn't one of the oldest gods known to us now, he was one of the oldest gods written about, at least that we know of. Second century millennium BCE, circa 1500 to 1400 BCE, Ball was the protagonist of the Ball Cycle from the coastal city of Ugarit, which is modern Ras Shamra, Syria, and was on Earth in the 1920s. The larger region where Baal was the major deity was called Phoenicia. The Phoenicians were an ancient Semitic people who inhabited city-states in Canaan and along the Levantine coast of the eastern Mediterranean, primarily present-day Lebanon and parts of coastal Syria. The Phoenicians had a massive maritime empire that, through trade and colonization, extended across the Mediterranean from the Iberian Peninsula to their heartland, and from Cyprus to Maharibo. For those who aren't aware, because I definitely wasn't, Maharibo is Arabic for Morocco, but also the Maghrib, or the Greater Maharibo, is usually defined as encompassing most of northern Africa, including a large portion of the Saharan Desert, but not Egypt and Sudan, which are considered part of the Mashriq, the eastern part of the Arab world. The traditional definition of the Maghrib restricted its scope to the Atlas Mountains and the coastal plains of Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, and was expanded in modern times to include Mauritania and the disputed territory of Western Sahara. Because of this sphere of cultural influence, Ball didn't only appear in Ugaritic texts. Oh no, he was also a major godly figure across the Levant and into Carthage, which is the Punic area in Africa, Mesopotamia, especially Sumerian, and even in Egyptian works. Though he is generally known by different names in those areas, or in the case of ancient Egypt's Middle Kingdom, maybe even Set. After all, gods and stories were often traded along with goods, and people played the game of telephone, and they adapted names and details to fit their own needs. Back in the 90s and early 2000s, even today, Stargate was no exception. The first thing I'll touch on is the Ball Cycle. It is essentially one long drama about Ball, or Baal Hadad, preserved on 6 tablets that stages his contested kingship with the Canaanite pantheon and his tense dealings with the great cosmic powers of Sea, Yam, and Death, Mot. It was written in the Northwest Semitic language Ugaritic, written on a cuneiform abjad. The text basically introduces Baal as a storm and fertility god rooted on Mount Zaphon, whose deity ship is praised, but is precarious when set alongside figures like Marduk in the Babylonian Enuma Elish, or Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible. Scholars usually break the story into 3 main components: Baal's battle with Yam on tablets 1 and 2, building of his palace in Temples 3 and 4, and his struggle with Mot in Tablets 5 and 6. Baal-Hadad is Lord of the Sky, governing rain, crops, and fertility. His absence brings droughts, famine, and social chaos. The fragmentary Baal cycle assumes substantial background knowledge, but portrays El, the high god dwelling on Mount Lel, presiding over a divine assembly. El appoints one of his sons, Yam, the sea, also called Nahar, river, as king of the gods, and renames him Mid-El, darling of El, commanding him to drive Baal from power. But in the ensuing struggle, in the opening tablets, Yam, the sea god, seeks royal authority over the other deities, and El, the head of the divine council, the big main god guy, and in some versions Baal's father, initially supports his elevation by commissioning Kothar Waz-Kasis, the divine craftsman, to build Yam a palace. Their narrative, though fragmentary, depicts the tense intra-divine politics in which El's decision threatened Baal's status and prompts anxiety among other deities like Aftar and Shapshu. Yam demands the surrender of Baal and his followers, and Baal responds violently to Yam's envoys until restrained by Anat and Aftart. In the ensuing god battle that they are not able to stop, Baal is initially weakened, but the craftsman god, Kothar Waz-Kasis, equips Baal with enchanted weapons, two magical clubs. He is able to defeat Yam. Aftar then proclaims Baal's victory and acclaims him as Rider on the Clouds, a title that is later applied to Yahweh in Psalm 68:4. Baal ultimately slays Yam, scatters his remains, and announces his death, publicly proclaiming his own kingship, ensuring warmth and stability for the world. The first phase of the cycle begins the classic Near Eastern conflict myth pattern in which the storm god asserts mastery over the chaotic sea powers and secures a form of cosmic and political hegemony. The middle section of the Baal cycle shifts gears from open warfare to the slow work of turning Baal's victory into a stable rule. It does that through something as concrete as palace construction. Even after defeating Yam, Baal complains that he still has no proper royal residency or court, and that is a lack that marks him as second tier next to the other high gods and leaves him effectively squatting in El and Atharet's domain. The negotiations that follow put family politics and the agency of goddesses front and center. Anat, Baal's sister or consort, threatens El with graphic violence on Baal's behalf, while Atharat, the head goddess, and in some versions Baal's mother, steps in as mediator, showing how kinship ties and female deity interventions shape who actually gets to rule. Kothar Waz-Kasis, the divine craftsman, produces lavish gifts for Atharat, and it is her culinary hospitality and intersection, rather than Baal's brute force, that finally coaxes the reluctant El into granting permission for Baal to build his own palace. Kothar then builds the opulent dwelling on Mount Zaphon out of cedar, brick, and precious metals, initially without windows at Baal's insistence, which may be a detail that may encode his lingering anxiety about renewed attacks from Yam or the vulnerability of his household, including his daughters. Only after recalling his victory over Yam and extending his rule over multiple cities does Baal allow Kothar to open the windows, an act dramatized in thunder and lightning. From this newly enthroned vantage point, he begins to consider how to handle future resistance by turning to Mot, setting up the final major conflict of the cycle. The last tablets bring Mot, the underworld god who personifies death, to center stage along with Baal. Baal invites Mot to a banquet of bread and wine, which, if accepted, would imply that Mot would recognize Baal's sovereignty. Mot, who is described as devouring flesh and blood like a lion in the desert, takes the offer as an insult to his very nature and responds with a threat to Baal to crush and consume him. When Baal hears about this, he agrees to become Mot's eternal slave and devises a plan in which a substitute, fashioned in his own image, is sent down as a surrogate victim. In Ugaritic religious texts, Baal reportedly mates with a heifer. And that child is what he sends down to Mot in his clothes, and that's what Mot actually eats, as he prepares for himself to go down as a powerless shade. When Groupon and Ugar return with the news of Baal's apparent death, El performs an elaborate ritual of mourning. This ritual involves stepping down from his throne, putting on a sackcloth, shaving his beard, and covering himself in dust while Anat and Shapshu carried out funerary rites and buried Baal on Mount Zaphon. El's attempt to install Athtar as Baal's replacement fails when Athtar literally and symbolically cannot fill Baal's throne, underlying that Baal's world charisma cannot simply be transferred to another deity. Anat then heads down to the underworld to confront Mot, who boasts that he already swallowed Baal at the entrance of his realm. Anat's response is shockingly violent and highly ritualized. She seizes Mot, attacks him with sword and fire, grinds his body, scatters the pieces for the birds, and then returns to proclaim his death before El. Yet drought continues. Soon after, El has a dream proclaiming Baal's survival until Shapash restored Baal to life, which he did. 7 years later, Mot, somehow reconstituted, which does make sense because he is the god of death, so if he died, he would just go straight back to his realm. Like, killing demons or devils in D&D, they just go straight back to hell and pop up again. You have to kill them in hell to actually kill them. That's neither here nor there. Mot reappears and demands compensation for the way that he has been treated, insisting that Baal hand over one of his brothers. Of course, he doesn't go for it, and the fight between them is renewed. A long, drawn-out fight that doesn't actually end with a decisive kill, but with a stalemate, which is finally broken when the Canaanite sun goddess, Shapshu, intervenes. She warns Mot that El now stands behind Baal and threatens to topple Mot's throne, because people and the gods need Baal. When faced with this new divine political reality, Mot breaks down and acknowledges Baal's kingship. The whole cycle closes, not with the destruction of death, but with a kind of uneasy truce, a negotiated settlement in which Baal's rule is reaffirmed, but still remains fundamentally fragile. Which, if you're looking at fertility versus death, you always have that balance there. So it's a pretty insightful piece of literature. Another episode alludes to Baal's victory over Lotan, the many-headed sea dragon. Another broken text leaves it uncertain whether Lotan is merely another name for Yom or it's a distinct figure, but the motif resembles Near Eastern myths of storm god and overcoming chaotic waters. Baal's palace is then built of silver, gold, and cedar from Mount Lebanon and Sirloin, and in his new residence, he hosts the grand banquet for the gods. Scholars have read the Baal cycle in several crisscrossing ways. A long-standing line of interpretation understands Baal's death and return, and Mot's brief ascendancy, as mirroring seasonal patterns of drought and rain in the Levant, with Baal functioning as life, death, rebirth deity, whose vulnerability reflects agriculture anxiety, two hot and dry summers versus autumn renewal, and failed versus successful harvests. A particular scholar, Oldberg, however, suggests that the myth is better seen as a response to more drastic episodes of drought and infertility rather than a much more predictable built-in seasonal allegory, possibly involving temporary booths that symbolically stand in for Baal's palace that may lie in the background of later Jewish practices associated with Sukkot, a 7-day Jewish festival, and is also known as the Feast of Tabernacles or Feast of Booths. On a wider comparative level, the ball cycle participates in the broader ancient Near Eastern pattern that I brought up just a couple minutes ago of the storm god's battle with the sea. With this in mind, it aligns more closely with the Egyptian and Anatolian versions, what they call version A, rather than the Israelite and the Babylonian, which is called version B, where creation typically follows the storm god's victory. Taken together with possible resonances, like in texts Daniel 7 and Revelation 21, 1-4, these features have led scholars to treat the Baal cycle as a key background text for Israelite and early Jewish reflections on divine kingship, cosmic conflict, and the ultimate subduing, but not outright destruction, of both the sea and death. We do have further character development. He is also called Hadad, or Hadu in Ugaritic, Adad in Akkadian, or Iskor in Sumerian. He is also the storm god of the Canaanite and ancient Mesopotamian religions, since he is just Baal. And since he was already prominent at Ebla in 2500 BCE as Hadad, this does put him earlier in the timeline than the Baal cycle by about 1,000 years. From the Levant, Hadad was introduced to the Mesopotamians by the Amorites, where he became known as the Akkadian, Assyrian-Babylonian, god Adad. Adad, usually written with a specific cuneiform logogram, and it is the same sign that is used for the Hurrian storm god Teshub, so they're probably the same deity as well. Hadad was also called Rimmon, Pidar, Rapu, and Baal Zephon, or simply Baal, though that is more of a title, and that could also apply to other deities. Which does also make sense through time when looking at names. Like, why, after centuries, would you keep calling your main god, your head god, by his name when he is the top god? Even though later El is still the ultimate ruler as the father, Baal tends to be an almost Jesus archetype as the son of God, who becomes more directly important to the people in the newer addendums to the story, especially since the Baal cycle presents him as effectively the new leader of the pantheon, displacing the more distant high god El by securing a palace and asserting control over the cosmic waters and death. In combat myths, Baal defeats Yamu, or Yam, the sea, and sea serpents like Tanin and Lotan. And Lotan is a cognate with the biblical Leviathan. And Baal is himself overcome by death, but then is resurrected, a pattern widely interpreted as the return of the life-giving storms. Plus, other scholars agree that parallel epithets for Zeus and Yahweh also underscored his role as a dynamic sky god. The bull was his symbolic animal, and he is typically depicted as bearded, often wearing a short kilt, holding a club or mace and a lightning bolt, and wearing a bull horned headdress. Epigraphic and iconographic evidence closely associates him with the bull invoked under a wide array of local epithets, such as Baal of Ugarit, Baal Zaphon, Baal Shaman, and Baal of Sidon. Contrary to what a lot of modern art that people use as thumbnails on YouTube, he was not generally shown as having a bull head like gods of Egypt. However, there is a stela from Bethesda, which is on display at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, that depicts a Canaanite deity, but it's more of a stick figure with a bull head and a very long penis that makes up the frame of the entire stela. And that is generally thought to be Hadad, but it doesn't have a name on it, so scholars are not sure. From the 2nd millennium BC onward, Baal's cult spread from inland Syria and Canaan into Egypt and across the western Mediterranean through Phoenician colonization and trade.
In Egypt, Baal could be equated with Set or Horus, reflecting the broader Near Eastern tendency to align local storm gods. If you listen to my episode on Set, then there was a time in the Middle Kingdom where Set was a representative of a foreign god, and that was the one that the Middle Kingdom pharaohs worshipped to a higher degree than Horus. So because it's a foreign god, it could tie to Baal, especially being a god of storms. However, Set may have originally been equated with a different local Baal, Baal of Tyre, whose storm traits were particularly highlighted in Egypt due to their foreign association. However, the other way, because Hadad was primarily the West Semitic storm god and the Hittite Shutek or Teshub likewise displayed storm and warrior characteristics, he could have been worshipped by foreign powers in Egypt. But all of these figures became linked to Set in Egyptian perception. This reflects a common Near Eastern mythic pattern in which an older chief deity is supplanted by a younger storm god, comparable to the Hittite cycle of Kumarbi, where Teshub replaces Kumarbi as the king of the gods, or Zeus replacing his father Kronos, or even Kronos replacing his father Uranus as king of the gods too. In Punic North Africa, Baal Hamon rose to prominence as Carthage's chief deity, particularly from the 5th century BCE. While sharing Baal's fertility profile, Baal Hamon is more closely linked to the ram, and his epithet Hamon remains debated, but is possibly tied to Haman, which means
brazier,
with more solar overtones, which also could have something to do with Amun,
a solar deity represented by a ram from ancient Egypt,
or to specific mountains and sanctuaries. The Tophet cemeteries in Carthage, which are places of ritual sacrifice, have urns containing cremated infant remains. They have been read by many scholars, including Roman authors,
so take this with salt,
as possible evidence of child sacrifice to Baal Hamon, but these interpretations of this data are still hotly contested, as is easy to imagine. So that's all I'm going to say about it. In Israelite literature, Baal becomes a central foil for the developing cult of Yahweh. The Hebrew Bible refers to Baal roughly 98 times, chiefly as a foreign or rival deity, with the narratives of Ahab, Jezebel, and Elijah dramatizing conflict between Yahwism and Baal worship, probably that of Melkart or Baal Shemem. Theophoric names containing Baal, like Jerubbaal, Eshbaal, Meribaal, Beliada, indicate the more complex earlier phase in which Baal could function as either a title for Yahweh or as a marker of Canaanite allegiance. Later changes that replaced Baal with Basheth, meaning shame, signaled a strong fight against the name and the cult. Baal will appear in many more texts, but again, changed to generally denote a false god or idol who is opposed to the true god and the prophet Elijah, and is even thought to be Beelzebub because of his other names or titles like Baal Berith in Judges, Baal Zebub, or Baal Zevov,
names which are transliterated into Hebrew as
Beelzebuth or Beelzebub, which just meant Lord of the Flies, which brings a whole new meaning to that book. This is what's argued, but I'm not completely certain about this. Not that this isn't who we connect him with now, but how people defined him way back then when they were originally changing his name. But this further illustrates how a localized covenant god or a Philistine healing god could be reread in Deuteronomistic, Jewish, and Christian traditions as emblematic of idolatry and eventually as the prince of demons. Islamic exegesis similarly recalls Baal as a false idol opposed by the prophet Elias. While the root, Baal, continues its everyday sense of lord, owner, husband in the normal language. Across these trajectories, Baal functions less as a single stable god and is more as a shifting cluster of titles, local cults, and polemical constructs that chart changing boundaries between native and foreign divine power and its repudiation. In Akkadian, Adad is also known as Ramanu, or Thunderer, a cognate with the Aramaic Ra-Ma and the Hebrew Ra'am, the bynames of Adad, even though earlier scholars treated Ramanu as a separate Akkadian god, he is now recognized as being another Hadad figure. Though originating in northern Mesopotamia, Adad was identified with the same Sumerogram DIM that designated Ishkor in the south. His worship became widespread in Mesopotamia after the first Babylonian dynasty. A text from the reign of Ur-Ninurta already describes Adad Ishkor as both threatening in his stormy rage and benevolent in bestowing life-giving rain. Ishkor appears in early godly lists from Shorobak, but seems to have been less important in Sumer, where irrigation reduced dependence on rainfall and storm deities like Elil and Ninurta and overlapped his functions. In some traditions, when Enki distributes destinies, he appoints Ishkor as inspector of the cosmos, praising him as a great radiant bull, son of Anu, lord of Kakara, twin brother of Enki, and lord who praises the storm, lion of heaven. In other texts, Adad / Ishkor is the son of the moon god Nana or Sin and Ningal, and the brother of Utu or Shamash and Inanna / Ishtar, or alternatively, on a completely different version, the son of Enlil. But the bull is clearly established as a sacred animal from the old Babylonian period, so at least early 2nd century BCE. There's just so much crossover here. In many texts, his darker, stormy aspect is the one that's front and center. Yet his association with the sun god Shamash, who alternates with him in governing nature, also gives Adad certain solar traits. Texts from the Kassite period and the region of Mahdi increasingly stress Adad's violent, warlike character, in contrast to Ishkor's more peaceful pastoral profile. Moving back to Adad in Aram and ancient Israel, in the 2nd millennium BCE, the king of Yamhad, or Halab in modern Aleppo, who liked to call himself Beloved of Hadad, received a statue of Ishtar from the king of Mahdi and set it up in Hadad's temple in the Aleppo chapel. The royal inscription of Shalmaneser I even calls Hadad the god of Aleppo. Hadad's name shows up a lot among ancient royal names, including Hadad son of Bedad, the fourth king of Adam, Hadadezer, Hadad's help, and the Armenian king defeated by David, and several kings of Damascus known as Ben-Hadad, which is the son of Hadad. The overall characterization across West Semitic and Mesopotamian traditions, Hadad, Adad, Ishkor, is a central storm god associated with weather, fertility, royal power, and divination. His powers emphasize combat against the sea and death, agricultural cycles of drought and renewal, and shifting configurations of divine kingship, plus the synchronistic identifications with deities such as Teshub, Zeus, Jupiter, Set, Horus, Baal Shamim, and Amun illustrate both the wide diffusion of his cult and the fluidity of ancient Near Eastern religious systems. In the Ugaritic and Mesopotamian art, Baal, Adad, Hadad, whatever, all of them, are usually shown as a striding male figure in a short kilt, wearing a horn crown and holding a mace or a club and a lightning bolt, sometimes standing on a bull or on a mountain. The cuneiform sign, the star and the weird square with extra lines, literally labels him as a storm god and visually links him to other figures like the Hurri and Teshub. Some iconic pieces are the Baal Stela from Ugarit in the Louvre. It shows the god stepping forward in the kilt with a raised club and the stylized lightning spear with other wavy lines that are read as clouds or sea. This image sums up his role as a storm god and cosmic warrior, visually connecting the sky, lightning, sea, waves, and warrior kingship with the regal striking pose and the crown. The various statuettes of Baal from Ugarit with the same power pose or the release of Adad in Assyrian palace art situate him in the cultic and royal landscape of temples, altars, and subject worshippers, which enforce their theology. Neo-Assyrian storm god reliefs of Adad from Til-Barsip, also known as Tel-Amar, show a figure in profile with the horned headdress and fringed robe, standing on a bull or a lion-dragon combo monster, and holding a trident-like bolt and a mace. The Hadad Stela from Sincerely again gives the same package, horned headdress, weapon, upright stance, but it adds an Aramaic inscription calling him Lord. Put together, these artworks kind of hammer home the same message. Baal, Hadad, is a storm warrior whose lightning, bowls, and horn crown guarantee rain, fertility, kingship, and overall cosmic stability. This iconography underlines the continuity between the West Semitic Baal and the Assyrian Adad. The same basic storm warrior type is now integrated in Assyrian royal art, where he appears alongside the king in processions and on palace walls, visually fusing the divine and imperial power. As Israelite and Jewish and then Christian monotheism developed, the visual system didn't disappear, but it was kind of pushed to the margins, broken up, and reinterpreted. In the Hebrew Bible, Baal mostly serves as a name rather than a recognizable image. The strong emphasis on an iconism and smashing idols means that Baal's older storm god iconography is dropped from Jewish religious art and instead lives on through texts and negative examples while still having influence on Baal's cloud rider epithet and storm characteristics and the bull symbolism from both El and Hadad. When Baal turns up in the Christian visual culture, it's usually indirect. He shows up as a generic statue or idol, or gets folded into demon imagery rather than looking like the Ugaritic or Assyrian storm gods we know from archaeology. The golden calf in Exodus 32, for example, clearly echoes Baal's bull symbolism, especially with the story of him having a calf for a child and sacrificing it. But the point there is to warn of idolatry, not to honor the storm god. Later demonological images sometimes make Baal into a horned bestial devil whose specific traits blur into those of other pagan gods turned demons. Over time, Baal's concrete Near Eastern visuals, the lightning bolt, DIM sign, and bull, as in the golden calf, fade into more abstract signs of false worship, so that in Jewish and Christian settings, he becomes more of a textual and theological figure than a clearly drawn character in art. I would like to provide some background on the character from the show before going into the direct compare and contrast section. Baal, on Stargate SG-1, was a Gwoll system lord who rose from being Ra's underling to one of the most powerful and enduring enemies of the Tari, Earth. Historically, he manipulates or is manipulated by, other Gwoll, like Sokar, Anubis, and the System Lords. He engineers massive military campaigns, and he uses gravity technology and supernovas as weapons. Baal begins his ride to System Lord status by reading the politics better than most of his peers. He proves both sadistic and methodological when he captures and repeatedly tortures to death and resurrects Jack O'Neill for information, and exploits the Avenger virus to cripple the Stargate network and strike at his rivals. and yet, later, leads the combined Goa'uld fleet against Anubis. During the Replicator Crisis, which is actually around the same time in Season 8, he cooperates with Samantha and Jacob Carter to retune the Dakara weapon and its DHD to wipe out the Replicators. After Anubis' fall, he seizes Anubis' Cole warriors and advanced tech, absorbs territories from defeated Goa'uld, even as his escape from Dakara publicly shatters the illusion of the Goa'uld as gods. With the old empire collapsing, Baal pivots to survival mode. He flees to Earth, becomes a corporate douchebag, takes over the Trust, and uses Asgard tech to mass-produce Baal clones. Individual clones attempt to brainwash the Jaffa High Council and seize Dakara. They steal and hide Stargates to rebuild his power base and manipulate the SGC into rounding up his own clones so he can beam them all to safety. One clone joins the quest for Merlin's anti-Ori weapon, and another captures Adria as a host, murders the fellow clones with symbiote poison, and briefly offers to help SG-1 against the Ori before the Tok'ra extract and then kill him. The real Baal's master failsafe is a time travel plot. In the movie Continuum, he goes back to 1939 to destroy the ship the Achilles and prevent the Earth Stargate program from ever even existing. Then he ends up ruling an altered timeline as dominant system lord with Teal'c as his first prime and Katesh or Vala as his queen. An alternate Cameron Mitchell ultimately ambushes Baal on the Achilles in 1939 and then kills Baal, and with the last clone's extraction, Baal and the entire era of the Goa'uld system lords ends, leaving only his recovered time machine as a reminder. So comparing and contrasting, let's first look at his name and identity. Baal didn't only have his name written by the Greeks. However, that was an important first step in how we got the word today. The Greek way of spelling the word Baal appears in the New Testament in Romans 11:4. And the Septuagint, and the name was Latinized in the Vulgate, a Latin translation of the Bible, from the late 4th century CE. I wouldn't fault anyone, past or present, for changing names or adding epithets because he had so many. And I'm not just talking about syncretisms or cross-culture equivalencies for disambiguation, although that did happen. Baal was himself called by other names and given many different epithets across different cultural areas, as far as we know. This is pretty easy to understand, because what is pivotal to remember is that Baal isn't just a god's name. In the Semitic language family, spoken in the ancient Levantine region, it's the most common noun for the title or honorific for lord, master, or owner. Baal was also used more generally for words like Baal Balim of arrows, as in archer or archers. Even in the Quran and in Hebrew, it means husband, and from its use, it came to be used for God as well. As we touched upon earlier, the ancient variation of Baal's name include Hadad, Romanized as Hadu, Adad, or Iskur. Evidence of these names appears in Ebla, one of Syria's earliest cities, around 2500 BCE, where it was recorded as Hada. Hadad originated from the Levant and was introduced into Mesopotamia by the Amorites, where he became known as the Akkadian Assyrian-Babylonian god Adad. Usually, Adad and Iskur are represented by a particular logogram that I discussed earlier, which features the asterisk-like symbol meaning god or goddess. This symbol is identical to that used for the Hurrian god Tashub, and other names associated with this deity include Ramon, Pidor, Repu, and with the epithet Baal-Zephon across different languages and scripts. Interestingly, since Hadad was often called Baal, meaning Lord, it becomes somewhat complex to automatically equate all of these names, especially given Baal's various epithets. These names are attributed to the same god based on shared stories across cultures and Baal's role as a storm, rain, and fertility deity. Therefore, this multiplicity comes from regional cults and linguistic variation rather than the physical duplication that Baal in the show has. Speaking of clones, the Stargate character is portrayed as the single Ghoul symbiote that embodies the godlike name to dominate humans. However, he later demonstrates the ability to create literal clones of himself through Asgard technology, as shown in the episode Deus Ex Machina. While the historic figure Baal's multiplicity is rooted in conceptual and cultural integrations, embodying the various epithets, the Goa'uld Baal's multiplicity is realized through the advanced technology and biological cloning, resulting in many identical individuals who share a single identity and purpose that actually work together at certain points of the show, but plotting to destroy all the others the next moment. After all, it's like Highlander, there can be only one. The series plays on the ambiguity surrounding the name Baal by portraying him as one among many false gods. In ancient stories from the Near East, Baal is mainly a storm, rain, and fertility warrior god. People believed that he sent the rain, controlled thunder and storms, and helped crops grow, so he was closely connected to farming and to kingship. In Ugaritic myths, he's the center of the big cosmic battles, fighting Yom and Mot, and he even dies and returns in a way that reflects changing seasons, or a big drought catastrophe and then coming back with the rain afterwards. His worship is tied to government and royal power, with kings ruling under his authority. The Goa'uld Baal from science fiction is very different. He isn't a real god, but a parasite with advanced technology. His godlike status comes from things like powerful spaceships and energy weapons, gravity control, and genetic science. Not real control, obviously, over the weather or fertility. Still, both versions of Baal sit higher in a larger hierarchy and are strongly linked to power, leadership, and life and death struggles. One as a nature god in myth, the other as a ruthless space warlord. Depicted as a regal human figure, the god is very different from the TV Baal. The TV Baal is shown as a well-groomed human male in an elegant host body, in ornate but tailored high-status clothing that blends sci-fi with faintly ancient or aristocratic styling, as in robes, leather, metallic accents, but also drawing on sci-fi, corporate, especially in the 9th and 10th season, and vaguely Near Eastern aesthetics, also based on early 2000 standards, rather than the direct Bronze Age iconography. So instead of horned crowns, you get stylized collars, jewelry, and sleek uniforms that mark him as elite and a bit alien. We know the original Baal's iconography with the temple carving, stela, and reliefs painting him in a cultic setting. Altars, offerings, rituals, ritual scenes, inscriptions with various names, Hadad, Baal, etc. But the Goa'uld Baal has the typical Goa'uld symbolism of the eye and serpent motifs while being framed by throne rooms, elevated platforms, and choreographed dramatic entrances. Instead of lightning bolts and bulls, his symbols are weapon systems, starships, and technological interfaces. They both use visual markers of elite power, regalia, thrones, and control over violent forces to signify divinity or lordship. Visually, ancient Baal and the Goa'uld Baal are almost opposites. The ancient god is rooted in natural imagery, the storms, the rain, the bulls, sometimes rams, mountains, shown in lasting stone and clay for worship, while the Goa'uld is framed by metal, starships, control rooms, and slick corporate-style costumes in a cinematic medium. The older images are sincere religious art expressing real beliefs, whereas the Goa'uld visuals are intentionally deceptive, using special effects and costumes to fake godhood and hide the alien, only appropriating the idea of ancient godhood, which is pretty ingenious for a character that embodies a god who was actually turned into a false god in his time. From the late Bronze Age temples at Ugarit to 21st century science fiction, the figure of Baal has remained strangely persistent in ancient texts and images. Baal, or Hadad, appears under a tangle of names, logograms, and epithets, yet consistently emerges as a storm and kingship deity whose lightning, bulls, and horned crown visualize a theology of fertility, royal power, and cosmic order. Stargate SG-1's Goa'uld Baal inherited his name and symbolic repertoire, only to reframe them through his cloning advanced technology and theatrical displays of power that expose godhood as something that can't actually be manufactured. Baal. Impudence. Jack. I don't know the meaning of the word. Seriously, impudence. What is that? Abyss. Seriously, the snark of these men. Of course, Baal is the straight man in this comedic duo that hits its peak in season 8. In any case, Stargate's rendition seems to honor both sides of how people today and throughout history have interacted with the Baal mythology. He was valued as a helpful deity, bringing the rains as the cloud rider, which brought fertility and life to the regions he presided over, but he was also seen as the same worshippers as a dangerous warrior, since he would bring the storms that could cause floods and destroy fields, villages, and even cities. It just gets more intricately tied with Stargate's whole thing of turning deities into pure evil, because Baal was already turned into a demon by our world's religious orders that still exist today. Which is probably why Googling Baal or looking him up on YouTube without being specific will get you dozens, if not hundreds, maybe even thousands of hits discussing him as a demon, devil, or something else that's against God and humanity. They were really able to hit a stride in Stargate when they placed Baal as the anti-hero, or when the ultimate villains of the season that he had a large part in were seasons 6 through 10, with Anubis, the half-ascended ancient, and the Ori, the other group of ascended beings that were collectively more like real gods than anything else before. Part of the point of the story is pondering, what is a god? And does seemingly ultimate power innately give one the power to force worship? The show answers the latter question for itself as a resounding hell no, but it actually leaves the former up to each character, and thus each watcher's own beliefs. As a character who came in at a time when we would never be taken in by the question of whether the Goa'uld are gods, Baal went against something stronger. The Ori were painted as the devil to the ancients' god, which could be its own episode, and Baal, on purpose or not, almost reflected the antithesis to the view that was forced on him and the cultures he stemmed from. Finally getting to say, no, I am not a demon, I fought against them. And then he just tries to fit in with the rich elites of Earth. A plan that didn't work then and really wouldn't work now. I don't know whether the writers of Stargate SG-1 knew or planned to make Baal such a nuanced villain from his first appearance in season 5, but they, along with the actor that played him, Cliff Simon, really built something special. I'm not blowing smoke when I say making him an evildoer, but also a reluctant anti-hero, was perfect for the final quote-unquote god that has been portrayed in so many different ways by people for over 4,000 years of human history. Well, I know we won't all agree, I think discussing Baal can be one thing that we can all enjoy playing around with. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Detours in Archaeology, Lord of the Storm, Lord of Clones, Baal from Ugarit to Stargate SG-1.
It would be amazing if anyone listening could subscribe to my podcast, to like this episode and all other episodes that they listen to rate and review it,
leave a comment,
and to share it with everyone you know. That is the way to get my podcast to different ears, and I really want to expand this and grow this into a whole community.
I really appreciate you dealing with my lack of being able to pronounce things.
If you have any comments, corrections, or questions, I encourage you to email me at detoursinarchaeology@gmail.com. You can comment directly on this podcast. You can go to my website at detoursinarchaeology.com and hit the contact button to contact me that way.
Head over to the website to read about and follow along with the text. See all the beautiful images that I included with it and the references at the end for all my citations.
I have a lot of new items in my online store. The link will be down in the description if you want coasters or t-shirts or bags or mugs or stickers or prints. All music comes from Scott Buckley at scottbuckley.com.au. After this, I'm going to be taking a bit of a break on the Stargate characters since I've run through pretty much all of the main villains. There is Lord Yu, but we may get to that. And going to do The Mummy Returns from 2001. Then I think I'm going to get into some video games. The fun fact this week: it is getting into summer, so people are staying out much later. And guess what is around? Mosquitoes. But for this episode, I'm not going to be talking about malaria. I will be reading the article by Nicole Garner Meeker on interestingfacts.com. That's called "Certain Drinks Make Humans More Attractive to Mosquitoes." I don't know if this is true, but they write, "There are a few ways to avoid itch-inducing bites of the mosquitoes. Wearing long-sleeved apparel and dousing yourself in insect repellent can help, but avoiding some beverages, particularly alcohol, might further protect you," which isn't as fun. But according to a 2010 study of mosquito biting preferences, beer makes humans more attractive to the paltry pests. Their words. Researchers found that Anopheles gambiae, a mosquito species in the genus responsible for transmitting malaria, were more attracted to humans who had consumed beer compared to those who consumed only water, and the results were evident as soon as 15 minutes after the humans began drinking. Other studies have produced similar findings. One examination of alcohol's role in mosquito meal choices found that those who imbibed just a 12-ounce beer were more likely to be pestered by the insects. It's unclear why beer primes humans to become bite victims, though some scientists believe that it could be partly linked to body temperature. Alcohol expands blood vessels, a process that slightly increases the skin temperature and also makes us sweat, two factors that may attract more hungry mosquitoes. For being such tiny insects, mosquitoes are incredibly effective in their ability to feast on larger prey. Their proboscises, aka the stick mounds, or straws, are created from a complex system that includes six needle-like mouthparts called stylets. When a mosquito bites, the stylet is used to hunt for nearby blood vessels. That makes the mosquito's job of finding food quick and easy work, a necessity for when dinner comes with risk of being swatted. It does make me wonder if it's just beer or if it's all alcohol, because all alcohol would theoretically have the same effects, but they did only try it with beer. Be careful out there, but enjoy your summer, and I'll see you in 3 weeks. And until then, stay curious, stay inspired, and keep taking those detours. Thanks.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.